This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
And I'm Orion Samuelson on Chicago's very own Roger. Thank you, and good morning to all of you out there. And checking in from our Huntley, Illinois studio this morning, where it's 70 degrees and sky brightening in the east. And as Matt said earlier, we're a few days over a week from the longest day of the year, and then you know what happens. Days start getting shorter. But anyway, a lot to talk about. As Roger said, a lot of activity today, festivals, horse racing, Belmont. I'll be at Arlington this afternoon to watch that. But before that takes place, there's a very special event I'm going to be involved in at the Vintage Wings and Wheels Museum in Poplar Grove, Illinois. That's just north of Belvedere off I-90. They have a tradition there, the Flag Day Ceremony, and I want to talk about that just a little bit later. But Jim Fazell, a week ago, started Gardening 101 for people who have not gardened before and wanted to give it a try, and he took us, I think, through the planting a week ago, but today he'll follow through with what you do once you get the seed planted. So at 8:30 after 5 o'clock on this Saturday morning, we'll get ready for that, and Jim will join us when we continue on the Saturday morning show. It's time again to say good morning to Jim Fazell, and a week ago we got through about half of Gardening 101 for gardeners who are doing it for the first time. So are we going to finish up the course today?
We're going to finish up the course today, and we'll talk a little bit about some alternatives to gardening out in the garden. Actually, we talked about laying out the garden from the plan that you drew and getting the soil prepared. Make sure when you prepare the soil that you break up the lumps and so forth. And even if you're going to do transplanting, make yourself a seed bed out there, because you need to have decent soil and good condition for these plants to go ahead and grow. It's a little late, as we said last week, to start some things from seed. So you want to buy transplants of tomatoes, peppers, herbs, onion sets for green onions. A little late to grow dry onions, but you still have plenty of time for green onions. And there's time to seed things like beans or beets, or actually it's perfect time to sow seeds of things like the vines, the squashes, the cucumbers, and some other hot weather kinds if you grow okra or mustard. Perfect time for that. If the soil is dry, before you plant, moisten it a little bit. Don't plant in muddy soil, but plant when it's moist enough that you can actually squeeze some into a ball and then crumble it. That's a perfect condition. I like to sow the seeds in rows, and then I like to cover them with boards to protect them from the sun and from pounding rain if that should occur while the seeds are trying to grow. Lift those boards daily to make sure the seedlings are coming up. Once they begin to come up, take the boards off, because they're not going to grow under the boards. They're going to get white-colored, and when you do take the boards off, they'll sunburn. Be sure that you remove the boards as soon as these plants start to germinate, seeds start to germinate. Once these plants are up, you can opt to not water, or you can water. If you don't water, you're not going to get the crop that you will get if you put moisture on there. You need to water maybe once a week. An inch per time is fine. Use a sprinkler so that you get good coverage. Or you can buy these setups for drip watering, which work very well. If you're mechanically inclined and can do that, they're excellent. It takes a little bit of work to get them set up. Water early in the day so the plants dry off. Now, a little bit about pest control. With weeds, we don't want to use herbicides in small gardens. It's a pain to have to mix them up, and the amounts that you use are critical. The hoe works very well. And what I like to do is go out in the evening with my hoe and inspect the garden. I walk the rows, just like we used to do out in the cornfield or in the bean field once in a while, and hoe out the weeds as you see them. With insects, instead of getting out your sprayer, pick off the shoot of tomato that's got aphids on it, or wipe them off with a glove on your hand. Just strip the bugs right off, and the plants will go ahead and grow. With diseases, keeping the leaves dry is important. Water the soil, not the plants. I like to try to avoid using chemicals because I'm lazy. And there again, you have to mix them absolutely correctly, and the amounts that we would use in a tiny garden are so small that it's not worth the effort. If you're going to use them, you need to be absolutely sure to identify the pests that you're trying to control and use the correct material as per the label. Read the label. When you buy the stuff, when you use the stuff, when you're mixing the stuff, read the label so you know exactly what you're doing. If you don't understand the label, find somebody who does. Now harvesting. We go through all this mess to harvest things. We need to pick at the peak of ripeness. You want to pick the stuff in the cool of the day so it's not been heated up by the sun all day and wilted. Pick early in the day. Actually, I like to pick stuff early in the morning as soon as the plants have dried off from the dew. So that's the reason we do this, and there are some other things that we can do for those of us who have little tiny yards or are on balconies and so forth. Let's talk just a little bit about alternative gardens. You don't have to garden in rows or beds. You can garden in borders. We have friends that live in condos. They have little gardens out in their tiny small yards. They have shrubs and annuals and perennials out there. You can plug a tomato plant here or a bush squash here and there, put in a couple of marigolds there for color. Just plug these in various places within the border that's already there. Now, the better thing to do with small spaces is you can use containers. And even though we have a garden, we have containers as well. They're excellent for small yards, something on your porch, especially for cliff dwellers, and there are plenty of us around this part of the country. Select a container that's not too big or too small for the plants you're going to grow. You don't want a huge 5-gallon can to grow one begonia, and you don't want a little 4-inch pot to try to grow a tomato. Select the plant, the pot that will fit the plant you're trying to grow. Now, it's important that you have containers that are not so light that they fall over. There are various kinds that you can get. The ornamental containers often don't have drainage in the bottom of them, which is important. They're made out of ceramics and pottery. They're nice looking. To grow plants, you really need something that's functional. These are designed for growing plants, or you can construct them for growing plants. They must have drainage in the bottom of them. If they don't have, you need to put that in them. Things like clay pots, so you can make wooden planters. The 5-gallon buckets that you can buy at the hardware store and so forth work fine. If they don't have drainage in the bottom, drill a hole in it. Drainage is exceedingly important, and these plants will not grow if they're standing in water. Now, if you have a ceramic pot that you want to have a plant in, get a liner that fits inside of it. Use holes in the liner, set it into this other container, but you're going to have to empty the container when it has water in it. Let the pot that's growing the plant drain, and then empty the big pot or the surrounding pot so that the plants are not standing in water. The potting mix for containers, garden soil will not work. You've got to use something that's much lighter. You can use a third of your garden soil if you'll mix it with a third sharp sand and a third organic material like compost or peat moss, or go out and get a bag of the commercial potting soil, the brown stuff with the perlite or sand in it, not the black stuff. Make sure that it's moist before you plant. Put these plants in a sunny location. Protect them from midday sun or drying winds, and set them where you can enjoy them, especially on the weekend. They don't have to be there the whole time. If you want to move them around, you can do that to take advantage of the best sun and so forth. What do you put in containers? A plant, a dwarf squash, a pot of greens, mixed flowers and greens, or flowers, tall ones and short ones and so forth. And care, you need to water them probably daily if it's sunny and warm. And make sure that the plants don't dry out. If they do dry out on you, you're going to lose plants, or you're going to lose production. You need to check every day, so that's a little more difficult to grow there than allowing on Mother Nature to take care of it. Again, pick when they're ripe. One last thing I want to mention is start yourself a garden journal. Whatever you're doing, containers or in the garden, it can be as simple as just a spiral binder. Put the date at the top, and on the side of it, you put what you've done. Anyway, that's about it. I think pretty well covers it for especially the beginning gardeners, but if you have questions, send them along and we'll try to field them for you.
Indeed we will, and I must say, Gloria has her potted cherry tomato plant on our tiny patio behind our home, and it's already producing green tomatoes, so we'll probably have ripe ones pretty soon.
Wow, we'll come over for a salad, Orion.
All right, we'll set a date. Jim, thank you so much. Jim Fazell, our specialist in ornamental horticulture, here on the Saturday Morning Show. 21 minutes after 5 o'clock here on this Saturday morning, and I'll be talking about a very special event taking place at noontime today. But Before that, about 20,000 people in the pork industry in the United States, as well as other countries, traveled to Des Moines, Iowa this week for the annual World Pork Expo. And Max Armstrong was one of those who was there. Had the opportunity to visit with the new president of the National Pork Board. I like this lady. She knows, I think, what she's doing. She is a native of Michigan, a graduate of Michigan State, but she is now a pork producer in North Carolina. Jan Archer is her name, and Max asked her what it felt like to be the president of the Pork Board.
Well, it's exciting. You know, certainly there's a little trepidation, but I've been really fortunate to have been handed the reins to this organization by somebody that I really trust and has worked hard to mentor me. And we have a new CEO about whom I'm so excited. So this is going to be an exciting year.
Here at this Pork Expo, what's your feeling about the sentiment among pork producers? How do they feel about the situation right now in their industry?
Well, we have a lot of pork coming online. We have a lot of, we've got some farms that are expanding. We've got a lot of product coming on. And that's going to be a challenge. You know, sometimes we're the victims of our own success. And I've been raising pigs for 40 years, you know, and back in the day, if you raised 17 pigs per sow, somebody patted you on the back. Now, if you're not raising 30 pigs per sow, somebody's asking you what's going on. So we just are a much more efficient industry now. The antibiotic issue is one that producers are focused on, our consumers are focused on, I, as a grandmother, am focused on. So it's something that we take very seriously, and those are things that we're going to have to be addressing in these next few years.
As the industry adjusts to those new regulations being brought forward in the use of those animal health tools, one thing that really is going to be a challenge, is it not, is working with a local veterinarian, because in some places, vets are hard to come by.
Max, you are so right, and that's going to be a challenge. We do not have enough veterinary coverage in certain parts of our country. It's not going to be as big of an issue for large producers that may have veterinarians on staff. For small independent producers, especially in areas that are not traditionally hog-producing areas, that's going to be a challenge. So for all of those people who are saying, I want to be a veterinarian, think about large animal veterinary medicine. We have a lot of companion animal vets. We need more large animal vets.
One thing that seems to be a challenge for this industry from time to time is having enough pork processing capacity, having enough slaughter capacity in the U.S. But I was counting the other day, there are at least four or five new ones coming on. This is kind of an unusual era, is it not, with that new capacity coming forward?
It is. There was one other time in our industry in 98 when we had a lot of pork that came online very quickly. And those of us who have been in the industry for a long time remember those were frightening days.
It was brutal. It was eight cents.
It was brutal. And can our domestic market take up all of that supply? Highly doubtful. So we really have to focus on our international markets and our exportability. So we have to retain that ability and focus on developing new markets for our product.
We move a significant amount of pork into the export channels already. It's what, about 25% of the pork produced in this country?
It is. One out of every hog trucks that you see on the road is probably leaving this country. That's absolutely right.
Is that percentage expected to grow?
It has to grow. It doesn't have any choice. With all of the new capacity we have coming online, we never leave a void. So if there's capacity, we're going to produce hogs to fill it. And if we're going to do that, we're going to have to expand our export markets. And we have a great product that we need to be able to sell overseas, and people appreciate our product. We have lost some markets because of issues with PED that we didn't have product to sell, with the port issues that we had. We lost some customers. And as anyone who was in sales knows, it's much harder to get a customer back that you've lost than it is to get a new customer. So we're going to be working hard for that, and we have people on our team that are doing that.
The industry's efforts to educate, become more knowledgeable about the production, the skillful, careful production of pork, stretches back more than a quarter of a century. And I was surprised. You pointed out it goes all the way back to 1989. You've made some giant strides. Reflect back a little bit on that work that has been done by the Pork Quality Assurance Program.
You know, 1989, we were worried about pork quality, the quality of our product, residue issues. That was really our focus.
You were concentrating on training employees, for example, weren't you? And the producers themselves on administering these products.
Absolutely. And we made huge strides. That just is a non-issue anymore. And now we can use PQA Plus to address a lot of other issues. There's a huge difference between a pig farmer today and a pig farmer 50 years ago. And one of the biggest differences is professionalism. And as anyone in any professional endeavor understands, it's all about continuous education. You have to keep yourself abreast of what's going on. And that's what pork producers today are doing, and one of the ways they're doing it is through PQA Plus.
And it isn't just being given lip service. I mean, you actually require folks to be tested to meet the certain specifications.
We joke that we produce 5 pounds of paperwork for every pound of pork. We have to prove everything we do. And that's, again, something else that's new. 50 years ago, what happened on the farm stayed on the farm. And now our doors and our windows are open, and we are very transparent. So if we say we're going to do something, we not only have to do it, we have to prove we did it.
Boy, I believe her. I think she'll get that done. She's the new president of the National Pork Board, Jan Archer, pork producer from North Carolina. She grew up in Michigan, but met a pork producer from North Carolina and went to that state. It's coming up on 28 minutes after 5 o'clock this morning, and I mentioned earlier that at noon today, I'll be joining a lot of other people at the Vintage Wings and Wheels Museum in Poplar Grove, Illinois. That's an airport and a museum that friends of mine have worked on and turned it into a very interesting place over the past years. And today at 12 noon, there will be a Flag Day ceremony commemorating the adoption of the flag of the United States and celebrating the legacy of Captain Chuck Downey, who was very instrumental in getting the museum going. He was born in 1924, became the nation's youngest naval aviator. In second place, as the youngest by 11 days, was George H.W. Bush, who sent a letter to Chuck Downey saying, "Yes, Chuck, you were the youngest naval aviator in the history of the country." Well, he passed away this past year. This was a Flag Day ceremony that he initiated, and now they've invited me to do the impossible job, do the job that Captain Downey did at this Flag Day ceremony. Open to the public, and if you haven't seen the museum, it's a great museum. After the brief program, there will be a tour of the museum and refreshments. Captain Chuck Downey, and what a story is his. Lived through 17 bombing missions, 2 kamikaze attacks, and the sight of several friends being shot down by the enemy, all as the youngest naval aviator of World War II. So come and join us today at Vintage Wings and Wheels Museum, a few miles north of I-90 at Belvedere Exit. It'll get underway at 12 noon. Look forward to seeing a lot of you there to pay tribute to Captain Chuck Downey. Saturday morning show, and we're right here on WGN Radio Chicago and WGNRadio.com. All right, Roger, at 25 minutes before 6 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show. Let me briefly mention one more event this week at the World Pork Expo in Des Moines, Iowa. The National Pork Producers Council unveiled a commemorative painting in recognition of the contributions to the U.S. pork industry by Roland Paul. Now, if you're a pork producer, you probably don't know him by the name Roland Paul, because he's been known forever as Pig Paul. He was honored for his nearly 50 years of work in the purebred swine industry and for his leadership in establishing a number of pork industry organizations, serving on the boards of directors of the American Yorkshire Club and the United Duroc Swine Registry, now known as the National Swine Registry, and as field man for the Iowa Swine Breeders Association. And he helped set up 24 state pork producer organizations. He was the first employee of the National Pork Producers Council, serving as Secretary Treasurer from 1966 to 1969. Congratulations to Pig Paul on that honor. Now, welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. Hello, everyone. I'm Orion Samuelson. This week, asking the question, are there any of these still open and operating? We'll answer that question after this. If you're tired of your clothing, your favorite jacket or your favorite tie or dress or whatever item is a favorite of yours, if you're tired of it being ruined by a spill or a stain, now there's hope thanks to Wink Wash Away Laundry Stain Remover. This easy and safe to use pre-wash stain remover really is a must-have in your laundry room for all washable, color-fast fabrics, including wool, cotton, synthetics, and even cashmere. And for those unexpected stains when you're on the go, well, watch them disappear with Wink Instant Spot Remover. Check them out. All of the fine products of the folks at Wink in Eldora, Iowa, at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. And now back to our question. So what am I talking about when I ask the question, how many of these are still open and operating? Well, I'm talking about the one-room, eighth-grade country school, the kind of school that I attended in ancient times as a boy on the farm in western Wisconsin. It was the O'Connell Grade School. One teacher, 40 students, teaching all eight grades in preparation for going into high school. The question was prompted by an email from a listener who communicated with me to tell me about an open house coming up at a one-room schoolhouse in Sycamore, Illinois. And when I mentioned that on my radio program in Chicago, I got an old-fashioned handwritten mail letter from another listener who told me about a one-room country school in DuPage County, also west of Chicago, that had students until 1991. I wonder how many are still operating today. The one-room country school, let me tell you what ours was like. 40 students. We taught all eight grades, and there were no computers, of course, and so we taught reading, writing, and arithmetic, along with history and geography and spelling and recess twice a day. That was life in a one-room, eighth-grade country school, but it also meant that the teacher had to arrive in the wintertime at least an hour and a half early to get wood in the huge furnace that stood in the back of the one-room country schoolhouse, get the fire going so it would be warm enough when students arrived. Yeah, we did have an outhouse for boys, we did have an outhouse for girls, and we didn't go to court to decide who could use which one. And if both were busy, there was a forest close to the school and handy trees to stand behind. I think I got an education that prepared me very well for life, and it taught me the work ethic and the fact that you work until the job is done, whether it's in school or on the farm. But if you know of a country school that is still open and operating, my email address is bigosam@aol.com. I'd like to hear from you. My thoughts on Samuelson Says.
Indeed, I would like to know if there are any one-room, eighth-grade country schools still teaching. So let me hear from you. Samuelson Says is a presentation of the Tribune Radio Network. Coming up, a discussion of this week's market activity in the livestock industry. Max will check in with Dennis Smith of Archer Financial when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show.
Dennis Smith, Archer Financial Services, joining us in the studio.
Dennis, let's talk about the cattle situation to begin with. After months of volatility, what's been happening there most recently as we've been watching the cattle market?
Well, a lot of frustration continues. We have a sharply discounted futures market trading well under the cash. A lot of volatility. Sometimes the volatility just seems to make no sense at all. There's a lot of good things beginning to happen in the cattle market. Weights are coming down. Marketings are becoming very aggressive. So these are two factors that we did not have all of last year, and these are positive factors. Exports, we think, are on the mend, on the recovery. So there's a lot of good things happening right now. If we could kind of get some confidence back into the futures market and get this sharply discounted board a little bit closer to the cash market. We continue to work with the CME in terms of the volatility and some of the issues and reasons for that volatility. It's not as easy to pinpoint and take care of as you would think. But, yeah, we're hopeful to see the market begin to settle down a little bit and hopefully become a more useful tool in the future.
You mentioned exports seem to be showing some improvement. Where in the world are we exporting more beef?
Well, we continue to have our traditional customers, and they continue to be involved, and we're slowly expanding some of our smaller customers. But, you know, Mexico, Japan, South Korea, our traditional customers continue to come to beef, and we are beginning to discount our beef products. So wholesale beef prices running anywhere from 15 to 20% below a year ago, finally showing some signs of helping out.
Coming into this new year, feedlot operators were looking at some nice, inexpensive feed costs. That's changed a little bit since the start of 2016. How's that having an effect?
Boy, has it changed, and that's been a surprise. I think the price of feeder cattle is still overvalued in terms of finished product, in my opinion. And one reason for it was a cheap feed. The other reason, grass fever, with pasture conditions outstanding throughout the United States. But regardless of how much grass there is, if you're going to pencil out a loss when you place those animals, we have a problem. So feeder prices, in my opinion, need to come down because now, as you've indicated, the price of feed is going up.
If we see, and there's a lot of nervousness, as you know, in the grain market about this growing season ahead and how heat could build, some are saying how dry conditions could stress the crop, how we could trim carryouts on corn and soybeans, if that happens, do you expect there to be that downward pressure on the feeders?
Yeah, I do think that the feeder cattle price in a general sense will adjust downward, and it really needs to give the cattle guy that's going to place animals an opportunity to turn a profit on fed closeouts. It's been a long time. Industry's lost a lot of equity on losses feeding cattle, so that is one ingredient that I think needs to cheapen up. Quite frankly, we probably need to end our beef cattle expansion as well. We don't want to get into an extreme oversupply situation.
That could happen, couldn't it? You know, that's one thing, just to shift gears a little bit. At World Pork Expo this week, they were talking about all of that pork coming along, and we're reminded of the efficiency that our operators are bringing to the table now. That was one subject that came to mind as we looked at all of the exhibits, all of the services, all of the products, all of the information at the disposal of pork producers now, and they seem to be continuing to ratchet up their efficiency, and that means more pork, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Record large production this year on the back of record large production last year, and we're exporting about 25% of that production. So there's a fine line there where the export market becoming so critically important. Certainly, U.S. producers are committed to feed the world.
Is there the possibility, and I was probing for the answer to this question at World Pork Expo this week, that 25% can continue to grow? Will it be up in the 30% range before too long?
Oh, I think so, and I think a lot of it will be moving to Asia. Interesting development. Recently, the Chinese government trying to discourage meat consumption in China with a growing middle class, that's going to be extremely difficult. I think they are quite concerned about feeding their population in the years ahead.
We heard some rumbling yet about the long-term effects of PED virus, what that did to our export capabilities, that West Coast longshoreman strike of a little more than a year ago, that did some damage to exports. Was it irreparable damage? They say some of those markets are hard to win back.
Well, no, I don't think it's irreparable. I think it will recover. And then look at some of our competitors, Brazil, for example, all sorts of problems. And who would you choose as a more reliable supplier of grains and meats, the U.S. versus Brazil? So I think in terms of competitors, U.S. will always stand out.
Let's talk about Brazil for a moment. How do you see what's happening down there affecting the global situation for meats?
Well, I think it's going to have a big impact, and I think it's just now starting to be felt in our hog market, the lean hog futures market, which has been moving sharply higher of recent. We're getting indications of pretty serious culling of sows, sow liquidation due to literally record high corn prices, no corn to feed. We're seeing that poultry producers are cutting back severely, and this is going to create a downturn in meat production. Brazil's our largest exporter of poultry meat and the fourth largest exporter of pork.
Those are important numbers to remember, aren't they?
Yeah, so they're having some real problems, and U.S. producers stand to benefit.
How much of the problem in Brazil was weather-related for that corn crop? How much of their problem is related to political challenges they have there?
Well, I think it's a combined situation with and how that impacts the currencies. When the real was very weak against the dollar last year, they chose to export a very large amount of their grains, including corn. Now you have the political situation even more uncertain. Now you have the currency strengthening up, and now you have a drought-impacted corn crop on their second corn crop. So it's kind of been a compounding situation, creating a real crisis in Brazil.
Back here at home, again, taking a look at the summer weather, how would you say meat traders are watching this summertime period ahead? And what kind of forecast have you guys been hearing for the summer weather-wise?
Weather-wise, we don't think there's a real serious threat at this point in the forecast. Let's put it that way. Heat coming up, I think, will actually probably benefit the young developing crop because there's lots of moisture. So obviously the importance is, does a dry pattern become entrenched, or do we go back to a normal rainy type and then hot and dry and then rainy? We don't see anything really severe developing at this point in time.
While there are those pockets that you hear about when you're talking to producers, the corn and bean crops have gotten off to a pretty doggone good start, haven't they?
Boy, you're over 70% good to excellent in both corn and soybeans. And while it feels like it's been a late season, it really hasn't been a late season. We're right on target. I think we're off to a real good growing season. And interesting grain market developments seem to differ with that. But there's a lot of things going on impacting grain prices.
It is more than growing season weather ahead then, right?
Most definitely. We feel like just a shift in the demand curve for grains is contributed to the rally since the middle part of April, and we're not even really solely focused yet on weather patterns, like many times we are in the middle part of June.
What role has oil played? The fact that not only did that price stabilize, but it has bounced back up some, does that figure into the equation?
Yeah, Max, I use crude oil as sort of a benchmark on global economy strength and or weakness. And I think that's an indication that global economies are doing better than expected. Certainly a lot of the people we sell meat and grain to are highly dependent upon crude oil revenue. So you're seeing an improvement in a lot of global economies. And I think it's a very positive long-term growth situation.
Dennis, it's always great to sit down with you for a few minutes. Thanks for allowing some time this weekend. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dennis Smith with Archer Financial Services in Chicago.
Remembering the greatest, with all due respect to Muhammad Ali, we'll be talking about Gordie Howe.
Gordie Howe is the greatest of them all. The greatest of them all, yes, the greatest.
And our friends from the Blackhawks will join me.
You can have your choice of all.
Steve Cochran's back Monday morning on 720 WGN.
When you think about it, productivity starts at planting. So it's time to rethink how productive your planter can be. We did, with the new Case IH 2000 Series Early Riser Planter. We rethought your row unit, so it's tougher, more accurate. We rethought your meter, took the most precise technology, factory installed it. we rethought every inch of the Case IH Early Riser planter to make it the most productive planter around. And if you think about it, that's exactly what you want. Learn more at caseih.com/rethink.
With the success of the Case IH Steiger Quad Track and Magnum Road Track tractors, it's no secret why Case IH is the leader of the track. So it wasn't surprising when the competition started imitating us. But only Case IH offers a five-axle design to give you a smoother ride and more power to the ground with less burning and compaction. Still, we're flattered. In fact, if we weren't already red, we'd be blushing. To learn more, visit caseih.com/tracks.
Do you have a plan in place to make your hard-earned money last through retirement? Listen to Investing Sense for help on how to make the right decisions for your financial future. Go to WGNplus.com and click business, and you'll find Investing Sense.
Do you have a painting to sell that is at least 50 years old? Call me, the Antique Lady, at 773-262-1000. Take a look around your home. That old painting on the wall may not be a masterpiece and may not be in perfect condition, but it could be valuable. A Glenview resident received a substantial check for an original watercolor she had planned to sell at a garage sale. A Chicago couple was pleasantly surprised when we purchased their oil painting, which needed restoration to both the canvas and frame. Call 773-262-1000 to schedule an appointment and receive a fair price for your artwork. BJ Antiques has been at 6901 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago for over 30 years. Whether your painting is in the basement, attic, or on the wall, please give me, the Antique Lady, a call at 773-262-1000.
It's 4.5 minutes before 6 o'clock news time here on WGN Radio, working from my studio in Huntley, Illinois, where the sun is coming up and the temperature 70 degrees, heading for 90 or maybe a little bit more today. But let's look ahead 1 week, because 1 week from today, Linda and Dale Drendel are opening their dairy farmstead in Hampshire, Illinois, to the general public for a dairy breakfast and farm tour 1 week from today from 6 to 11 a.m. The dairy breakfast and farm tour being sponsored by dairy farmers from DeKalb and Kane counties. But you'll have the opportunity to let your kids pet dairy calves. You'll have an opportunity, if you get there early enough, to watch cows being milked. And maybe your kids will suddenly understand that milk doesn't appear in the cooler section of your supermarket. It actually starts on a farm with real cows. Milking demonstrations will be on the schedule from 6 to 9 a.m., so that's 1 week from today. And the other thing I want to mention is the fact that Gloria and I will be there, and we'll be joined by Steve and Johnny of the all-night show on WGN Radio a few years ago. They have written a book, and of course I've written a book, and so from about 8 to 10:30 or so, Steve and Johnny and Gloria and I will be at the table, and if you've received my book as a gift and would like it signed, bring it. I'll be happy to sign it. We'll also have some for sale there. But anyway, the Drendel Farm address is 15N057 Walker Road, Hampshire, Illinois. Farm located 2 miles southwest of Hampshire, and of course, not too far off I-90, heading out to Rockford and beyond. So that's a week from this morning, and hope that we will see a lot of you there. And then another of the many notes I get: my name is Colton Kimpling, and I have the pleasure of serving as the 2015-16 Illinois FFA State Reporter. And one responsibility of mine is coordinating the Illinois FFA Convention Media Booth and the Farm Credit Newsroom. Well, when does that happen? The 88th Illinois State FFA Convention happens this week, June 14 through 16 at the Prairie Capital Convention Center in downtown Springfield. Colton, thank you for the invitation. I don't think I can make it this week, but My spirit will be there with you because you know how I feel about the leadership qualities of the FFA organization, along with 4-H, two of the best youth leadership organizations in the country and the world. So that's coming up this week. A lot of other state FFA conventions are also happening during the month of June, and I wish all of them a great deal of success. And then finally, just have to comment on the market activity this week. We really saw unusual things. A heat wave generated rally of 40 cents in the soybean market. We're in the second week of June, and we're already getting bothered by a 2 or 3 day heat wave. A little early, I think, to get concerned about that and its impact on the crop. But it did push soybeans up 40 cents on Wednesday. And then we ended the week with the soybean market ending higher for the ninth consecutive week. And I was surprised, and maybe you are too. It's been 43 years since we have seen that kind of a bull run in the soybean market. So it's going to be interesting to watch that one. Corn prices also hitting some pretty good highs before profit-taking set in. So market world is always interesting and exciting. I'll see some of you today out at Poplar Grove, Illinois, at the Vintage Wings and Wheels Museum, and then maybe later see some of you at Arlington Park Racecourse for the Belmont. Big day in the racehorsing industry. Thank you for joining us, and this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.